Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, Ana Mateo brings you the Health and Lifestyle Report. We'll also hear from Jonathan Evans and Ashley Thompson. And we close the show with our American History Program, The Making of a Nation. But first,
major repairs to the Church of the Nativity are lifting spirits in the town of Bethlehem just before Christmas. Many Christians around the world celebrate Christmas on December 25th. That is the day they believe Jesus was born. Many believe the Church of the Nativity was built on the site where Jesus was born. Bethlehem city officials hope the repairs to the church will bring in more visitors and improve the weak economy in the West Bank. They also hope the repairs might help keep more Christians in the area. Bethlehem Mayor Anton Salmon told the Associated Press that Christians are leaving the area, known as the Holy Land, because of conflict and economic difficulties.
Repairs to the Church of the Nativity started in 2013. That came a year after the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, declared the church a World Heritage Site. The repairs are expected to be completed by the end of next year. The Palestinian Authority, which governs the territory, formed a committee of local Christian leaders to lead the project. They also employed an Italian company to carry out the repairs. Ziad Al-Bandak is head of the committee. He said the group has collected $14 million out of $17 million needed. Almost half of the money has come from the Palestinian Authority and local Muslim and Christian businesses. The rest came from foreign donations. "It has become such a beautiful church," he said. "Every Christian in the world would love to see it now." The church is considered one of the holiest places in Christianity. It was built in the 4th century by Saint Helena over a cave where the Virgin Mary, Jesus' mother, is said to have given birth. The church was destroyed by fire and rebuilt in the 6th century under Byzantine Emperor Justinian I. For years, there had been no repairs done to the building. The roof of the church was leaking, windows were broken, art was covered in dirt, and walls and support structures were damaged. After 5 years of work, it has been completely changed.
Imad Nassar is a Palestinian engineer with the repair project. He said the project started with the roof. Some of the roof supports were replaced with wood from old destroyed churches in Italy. Windows were fixed and outside stones and walls were repaired. The biggest problem has been repairing the badly damaged 2,000 square meter wall mosaic. So far, 120 square meters have been cleaned, showing images of Jesus and other Christian figures. Workers are also repairing a floor mosaic. Under a 19th century agreement, the Roman Catholic, the Greek Orthodox, and the Arminian churches have been responsible for their own areas of the church. Disagreements among the three Christian organizations have left the church in a state of disrepair. The Palestinian Authority has been credited with settling the dispute. But the repairs have not included the altar, with the 14-point silver star that marks where Jesus was said to have been born.
Bethlehem depends heavily on visitors around the Christmas holiday. Local hotels, restaurants, and gift stores do much of their business during the short holiday season. The repaired church has become a popular destination. After dropping in 2015 and 2016, the number of visitors has risen in the past 2 years, officials say. The mayor said he expects 1.2 million visitors this year.
Artificial intelligence technology may soon be a useful tool for doctors. It may help them better understand and treat diseases like breast cancer in ways that were never before possible. Rishi Rawat teaches AI at the University of Southern California's Clinical Science Center in Los Angeles. He is part of a team of scientists who are researching how AI and machine learning can more easily recognize cancerous growths in the breast. Rawat provides information about cancer cells to a computer. He says this data helps the machine learn.
You can put the data into them, and they will learn the patterns and the pattern recognition that's important for making decisions.
David Agus is another USC researcher. He believes that machines are not going to take the place of doctors.
Computers will not treat patients, but they will help make certain decisions and look for things that the human brain can't recognize these patterns by itself.
Once a confirmed cancerous growth is removed, doctors still have to treat the patient to reduce the risk of cancer returning. The form of treatment depends on the kind of cancer. Currently, researchers take a thin piece of tissue, put it on a small piece of glass, and add color to better see the cells. That process could take days or even longer. Scientists say artificial intelligence can do something better than just count cells. Through machine learning, it can recognize complex patterns or structures and learn how the cells are organized. The hope is that machines will soon be able to make a quick identification of cancer that is free of human mistakes.
All of a sudden, we have the computing power to really do it in real time. We couldn't have done this. We didn't have the computing power to do this several years ago, but now it's all changed.
Agus adds that the process could be done for almost no cost in the developing world. He says that having a large amount of information about patients is important for a machine to effectively do its job in medicine. The University of Southern California researchers are now only studying breast cancer. But doctors predict artificial intelligence will one day make a difference in all forms of cancer. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. For some people, walking or running outdoors is a great way to exercise. What may not be so great is seeing trash all over the ground. Well, some people are doing something about it. They are plogging, which is great. But what is it? Plogging began in Sweden. The name combines the Swedish word plocka, which means to pick up, and the word jogging, which means to run slowly. A Swedish man named Eric Ahlström started the movement in 2016. On the World Environment Day website, Ahlstrom says that he moved to Stockholm from a small community in northern Sweden. Each day, he would ride his bike to work. He says he became concerned about the amount of trash and litter he saw each day on his way to work. So he took matters into his own hands. He began picking up the trash. And that is how plogging was born. Plogging, by that term, may have officially begun in Sweden, but many people who exercise outdoors have been doing this for years. Take Jeff Horowitz, for example. He is a personal trainer in Washington, D.C. He says that he would often pick up trash while running outside. He even turned it into a game. He would try to pick up the trash without stopping.
I didn't even know it was a thing, really. This was just my personal ethic, where I would go for a run, and if I happened to see a piece of garbage laying around and it was within reach, it was kind of a little test of mine to see if I can grab it and throw it in a nearby trash can without stopping. And that way, I thought it gave me a little bit of exercise, a little focus to my run, and it helped clean up the neighborhood. And then I come to find out this has actually become an international movement, that there are people all around the world now doing this.
Today, plogging is an official activity, and one that is becoming more and more popular. Plogging is equal parts exercise and community service. As Julie Lawson explains, it can also build closer social connections in a community. Lawson works at Washington, D.C.'s Office of the Clean City.
When the street looks bad and it's dirty, you're going to feel bad about the neighborhood, about the community, may even feel less safe because of that. So if we are all doing our part and picking it up, it's very easy to help beautify it, help build those social connections. You get to know your neighbors. You get to feel some social responsibility and community feel when you do this.
Plogging can be fun, too. When Dana Allen goes plogging around D.C., she invites her friends, and they make a day of it.
Sometimes we get groups together on a Saturday or Sunday. We go for a run, we'll pick up some garbage, then we'll actually go for brunch after, and we'll kind of make a little bit of an event of it.
Although Allen enjoys plogging, she says she does not do it all the time. When she is training for a serious marathon race, the trash has to wait.
When I'm training seriously for a marathon, I probably wouldn't be as inclined to stop regularly when I'm running because I'm focused on a certain goal. But then there's other days I'm out and just sort of more relaxed running and just having fun. And that would be a situation where I might be more inclined to do it.
Cities around the world now hold plogging events. The goal is to spread the idea that littering is not acceptable. Allen hopes one day there will not be a need for plogging.
I would just hope people would think twice before dropping their garbage on the ground. We have receptacles, seems like, every block, so it's easy to put your garbage in the trash cans. I just think people should think about it a little bit more. And
along with cleaning up the environment, there may be another reason to choose plogging instead of just jogging. You may get a better workout. One fitness app, LifeSum, records 1 hour of plogging as burning 288 calories. Usual jogging burns about 235 calories. Getting ready to plog is similar to getting ready to jog. Ploggers do some deep knee bends or squats, as well as some balancing exercises. Then ploggers do something most regular joggers do not do. They put on protective gloves.
Gloves are important. You want to make sure that this is going to be healthy for you. You never know what you'll find. It might be broken glass, medical waste.
There are other safety rules for plogging. The main one is to plog in areas where there are not too many other ploggers. This helps to prevent plogging accidents. Ploggers must always pay attention to those around them. Stopping quickly in front of someone to pick up an empty bag of potato chips, for example, could cause a crash. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of America's second president, John Adams. He took office in 1797. He had served 8 years as vice president under President George Washington. Now state electors had chosen him to govern the new nation. Adams was an intelligent man. He was a patriot and an able diplomat. But he did not like party politics. This dislike caused trouble during his presidency because two political parties struggled for power during his time in office. Adams was caught in the middle. John Adams was a member of the Federalist Party. As president, he should have been party leader. But this position belonged to a man who really knew how to get and use political power, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had served as Treasury Secretary under President Washington. Now, Hamilton was a private citizen, a lawyer in New York City. But he continued to have great influence over the national government. Federalists loyal to Hamilton controlled the Congress. Even President Adams' top cabinet secretaries were loyal to Hamilton. In fact, they worked together against the new president. This political situation made Adams' term in office very difficult. It also led to the end of Federalist Party power. John Furling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He says every 50 years or so, the country experiences a period of extreme partisanship. He says the late 1700s were such a time. That partisanship helped split the Federalist Party.
They never were a viable party again after the election of 1800.
Two major issues marked Adams' presidency. One concerned foreign policy. The other concerned the rights of citizens. The first involved America's relations with France. Americans were divided on whether to support the revolution in France. At first, many saw it as similar to the American Revolution against Britain. Vice President Thomas Jefferson especially supported the French. France helped America win its war for independence from Britain. The country's friendship continued when Thomas Jefferson served as minister to Paris. But many Federalists came to strongly oppose the revolution in France. They were horrified by the execution of the French king and queen. They did not like the idea of common people taking power. Federalists wanted an alliance with Britain. Over time, they demanded war with France. They used their power to prevent the American government from sending a pro-French representative to Paris. They also searched for any signs of insult, any excuse to declare war. John Furling says President Adams did not agree with the majority of Federalists.
Adams, from the very beginning, seeks and what he called an honorable peace. He tried to look for some sort of central position, centrist position, between the radical conservatives on the right and the radical liberals on the left.
Adams was afraid that the French Revolution would destroy America. He believed the American economy and government would collapse if the country became involved in Europe's struggle. So Adams tried to improve relations with France through negotiations. At the same time, Adams strengthened America's defenses. "We will be ready," he said, "if war comes." One incident especially brought France and America close to war. It is known in American history books as the X, Y, and Z affair. President Adams had appointed a committee of ministers to negotiate with the French government. French officials kept the ministers waiting for several weeks. While they waited, the ministers had a visit from three Frenchmen, later called X, Y, and Z. X, Y, and Z told the American ministers that France would sign an agreement if the United States did three things. It had to lend the French government $12 million. It had to apologize for anti-French statements in a recent message from President Adams to the American Congress. And it had to pay the French foreign minister $250,000. The American ministers were willing to pay, but they wanted to sign the agreement first. The French foreign minister refused. First the money, then the agreement. The Federalists finally had the excuse they were looking for. France had insulted the United States. The only answer was war, they said. Federalist newspapers added fuel to the fire by publishing anti-French propaganda. In a few places, pro-war groups became violent. The Republican Party could do little. Even Thomas Jefferson was helpless. He remained in Philadelphia, the capital of the United States at that time, but he had few friends there anymore. Congress quickly passed laws to create a permanent army and navy. It also approved new taxes to pay for them. And it passed two new laws by a narrow majority. These laws greatly increased the powers of the national government. They were known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. Federalists said the laws were necessary to protect national security. But in effect, the Federalists used them to weaken the power of the Republican Party. Under the Alien Act, the president could accuse any foreigner living in the United States of being a threat to national security. He could order that person out of the country. The act also increased the time a foreigner had to wait to become a citizen from 5 years to 14 years. Republicans were furious. Most foreigners, when they became naturalized citizens, joined the Republican Party. Republicans argued that the Alien Act violated the Constitution. They said it gave the government more powers than were stated in the Constitution. Federalists said the act was constitutional. They said the Constitution gave the government the right to defend the country against foreign aggression. The other law, the Sedition Act, barred the publication of anything that might incite public hostility against the government. Republicans argued that this act violated Americans' constitutional rights of free speech and a free press. Federalists once again defended it as necessary for national security. The Federalists tried to use the Sedition Act to quiet Republican critics of President Adams' administration. About 25 people were charged under the Sedition Act. These included several leading Republican newspapermen and a Republican member of Congress. Some of the men were tried, found guilty, and sent to prison. But other Republicans took their places in the fight against the act. The Federalists' plan to stop criticism did not succeed. President Adams had signed the Alien and Sedition Acts into law. He believed they were necessary to protect the United States at a time when war with France was still possible. And his wife Abigail believed that passing the laws would stop newspapers from criticizing him.
The one piece of advice that she offers that is unfortunate and in fact catastrophic is that she really urges him to pass the Alien and Sedition Acts, which becomes the biggest blunder of his presidency.
Joseph Ellis is a history professor at Mount Holyoke College and the author of a book about John and Abigail Adams. He says Adams regretted passing the laws. In early 1799, Adams received several reports that France was ready to reopen negotiations on improving relations. He immediately nominated a new minister to France. Federalist senators threatened to reject the nomination. In the end, Adams agreed to nominate a committee of three ministers. The Senate approved them. It was many months before the three men went to France to negotiate the agreement, and it was many more months before they completed their work. But they did so on September 30th, 1800. After several years of bitter political struggle at home, President Adams finally prevented war with France. Later, he wrote that there was one thing he would like to be remembered for more than anything else. He gave himself the task of making peace with France, and he succeeded.
We can't say that about every American president, but we can say it about John Adams.
Historian John Ferling says he believes the United States would not have survived if the Americans had gone to war with France. Historian Joseph Ellis agrees.
I think that the long-term achievement of the Adams presidency is to preserve the coherence of a stable government and to see that the revolution survives and consolidates its energies and continues on into the 19th century.
1800 was another presidential election year in the United States. The Federalist Party appeared to be dying. The Republican Party had more popular support. It also had gained an increasing number of seats in state legislatures and in Congress. Party leader Thomas Jefferson was sure to be elected president, unless the Federalists could find a way to change the electoral process.
And that's our show for today. From VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.